from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour dates to April 28, 1996, in a place called Port Arthur in Tasmania, Australia. A 28-year-old man opened fire during the lunch hour and eventually left 35 people dead. He used several weapons in a killing spree. Australia had recently elected a very conservative leader, John Howard, and the government responded quickly. Within months, the country essentially passed a ban on high-powered firearms, some of the kinds that were used in the Port Arthur massacre. Now, in 2013, John Howard would write that passing that ban was not easy. It involved a mandatory buyback, or perhaps more accurately, a kind of government confiscation program. Howard said that Australia would never seek to take away all guns, but he said it was clear after that massacre that the people wanted limits to gun ownership and availability. Last week, President Obama referenced Australia's successful gun control, and so far, the data shows the following. In the 18 years before the mandatory buyback and confiscation, there were 13 mass shootings, and since then, Australia has had none. This hour, we begin with a look at exactly what Australia did and whether it's worth attempting something similar to the United States, and if not, what, if anything? My guests for the hour include Chris Eads, the chairman of the Monroe County chapter of SCOPE. That's the Shooters Committee on Political Education. Chris, great to have you back.
Thank you.
Also here is Gary Puttup. Gary is a former career police officer. He's with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. He's also an NRA range safety officer and a trainer for critical incident management, among other things. And Gary, it's nice to have you back as well.
Hello, Devin.
And on the phone with us, we have Colette Martin, who is with the Parents Against Gun Violence Committee. Now, Colette is calling us and on the line with us from New York City. Is that right, Colette?
That's right. Good morning.
Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate that. And before we dive into the conversation, just a brief couple of kind of housekeeping notes here. We're trying to do something constructive this hour. And as the host of this program, I'm going to set some ground rules. I understand the emotion that comes with this issue. I understand the frustration and fear and sadness and suspicion. But I also believe that the vast majority of us want the same thing. We want a safe country, a safe place for our kids to grow up. Gun owners don't value their guns above the safety of their children. They actually believe their guns make their kids safer. Those who don't own guns are not weak or soft or desirous of an all-controlling federal government. Again, I think we want the same things. And if we are going to move forward and change the tide of gun deaths, we will have to change the minds of those who disagree. Chris is going to have to change Gary's mind, or Gary's going to have to change Chris's mind. And it begins with deciding that we're not going to make those who disagree with us into the other. In this country, we've got a long history of othering. We tend to other immigrants, non-whites, gay people, atheists, Christians, Muslims, Jews. I could go on. And when we talk about gun violence, we tend to turn those who disagree into the other, the idiots, the people who don't care about our children. When we other, we're not going to break through. We are going to build walls. So today on this program, you can call the program, and later this hour we will get to your calls, but I'm asking you to be open-minded and to start with the premise that anyone who disagrees is not evil or cruel or weak. We are Americans, and we've got largely the same goal here. So that's where we will start. And let me also start by introducing a colleague named Matthew Leonard. He's the editor of the Innovation Trail. He is a native Australian. And I want to start with a brief conversation that I had with Matthew about the Australian government's action following that 1996 massacre. Matthew, you lived in Australia in 1996 when this happened.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it was a monumental event. It wasn't completely unprecedented, though. There had actually been a couple of similar events in Australia and in New Zealand before 1996, not on the same scale, obviously, but kind of similar scenarios.
What we would call mass shootings.
Absolutely, yeah. One in a very highly populated street in the city of Melbourne, which was, I think, killed 7 people. So not without precedent, but obviously on a scale that really just hadn't been imagined before.
When we hear, whether it's the president or advocates for gun control in this country, when they refer to Australia, they often refer to a buyback. My understanding was this is a forced buyback, a mandatory buyback, which is just another word for confiscation. Yes?
Right, except under the Australian Constitution, there is a transaction more than just a confiscation. So there has to be some sort of compensation offered by the Commonwealth, which is the federal government in Australia that controls all of the states and is able to enforce this particular buyback. And this was done under extremely conservative government of the day, the Prime Minister John Howard, who moved very quickly and effectively over the 6-month period, essentially to soak up a whole lot of weapons that had become outlawed under new legislation that was passed in the wake of the Port Arthur massacre. So a couple of things. I mean, I think it's important to realise that there are very important differences between the situation in Australia and the United States. I mean, Australia did not have entrenched in its constitution the same kind of amendments that guaranteed access to arms in some form as under the American Constitution. And the way that the population is distributed and the cultures in Australia are kind of really different as well. So it's just, I think it sometimes it seems like a good comparison because it comes off the back of a similarly horrific set of events. But in fact, the differences in terms of population dispersal, the rural-urban divide, which is really strong, and just population density and other factors, as well as the legislative stuff I've referred to, sometimes makes the comparison a little forced.
On population density, this is an important point because we tend to think of cities, rural, you know, maybe more in favor of gun enforcement in cities, less in rural, if we want to kind of boil it down that way. Australia's population, whatever we think about the country, it's really concentrated in cities, something like 85% urban and in cities, yes?
Right, and also geographically concentrated across, along the eastern seaboard, which is the part that faces California, where you have the major population centres, and then you have a couple of other capital cities that are, you know, relatively large, you know, cities, you know, in the several millions of population, but you don't have the same kind of dispersal of rural and medium-sized cities across the Midwest the way you do in the United States. So the actual logistics of doing, in a sense, the logistics of doing it were a little bit different, even though you're also dealing with a much, much smaller population. You know, like, you know, at that time, it would have been a little over 20 million people in Australia. So comparing that to the scale of effort that would be required in the American situations, again, makes it a very different situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we talk about numbers. First of all, this was not all guns in Australia. Whatever you heard about confiscation or buyback in Australia as if all guns were gone, my understanding was roughly a third, about a million guns.
Right, or even less. And it was very particular. I'm just looking at some notes quickly to be accurate. Semi-automatic rimfire rifles, shotguns, pump-action shotguns, and as we'd expect, high-powered or what are called military-type semi-automatic rifles. Now, a lot of those, if they're not in criminal hands, say organized bike gangs, which are a real issue in certain parts of Australia, and there was a far-right wing sort of faction that were also harboring guns, there was kind of a neo-fascist thing going on at one point in Australia. You're looking at where they're most likely to be is in vermin control, you know, like kangaroos, buffaloes, in you know, cattle stations and in rural areas. But those rural areas, you know, there may be several guns in a household. They're all on working properties, we call them in Australia, properties or farms, agricultural operations, where there might be staff who are controlling feral pigs, they might be controlling kangaroos, they might be using them in a whole lot of ways. And so, you know, the actual crime that was the instigation for all of this happened in, you know, one of the most sort of sparsely populated and you know, rural kind of areas of Australia as well. And so it's not like you're going into to very, very dense, highly populated urban areas and trying to deal in trafficked firearms on an immense scale, as we know happens, say, in New York State.
Okay, and so if it was under a million guns, but still, I think it was roughly a third of the firearms in Australia that were confiscated under this program, a similar program in the United States would be roughly 100 million guns, and that's just a scale that is hard to imagine even being feasible.
Right, sure. You're also looking at a different history. I think the weight of history is really important to consider. You know, having lived in the States now for over 4 years, getting a sense of how that kind of plays out. I think they're also now looking at some of the commentary that's come around. There's been a little bit of slippage. I mean, this was something that happened. They did another buyback in 2003 in Australia, took on about 50,000 essentially target pistols that were sort of less than .38 caliber pistols. Now there is definitely talk, particularly in the state of Victoria, which is down in the southeast corner, of the need to institute another compulsory confiscation / buyback because there's been a flood of illegal weapons come onto the market. Some of them have just been happened through unscrupulous dealers or through casual, unregulated transactions. You know, someone's uncle dies and they have a bunch of shotguns in the shed and they sell them to their friends, that kind of thing. And so there is actually a call now for a renewed effort more than 12 years after the last buyback to do it again. So I guess the lesson that I would say out of Australia is that a once-only event doesn't really address the problem in the longer term.
Okay, and the last question would be, for those who have sort of simplified the Australian reaction, which was Port Arthur Massacre 1996, do you recall public sentiment at the time?
I think there was overwhelming public support for trying to take those kinds of highly dangerous firearms out of the hands of people who shouldn't have access to. And I think there was general support for the initiative, and there were still holdouts, as you would expect. But I think overwhelmingly, and I was working in public broadcasting at the time with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, there was very, very strong public sentiment in support of the effort.
That's Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail and a native of Australia who was working in his home country at the time of the 1996 Port Arthur massacre, talking about that. And again, we want to start there because you've got President Obama, among others, referencing Australia. You have the Brisbane's main newspaper wrote an editorial last week and said the following, quote, America prides itself on being a light in the world for democracy and liberty, yet within its borders it is armed to the teeth. This is a tyranny born on a historical anomaly that must end. Surely if the phrase land of the free stands for anything, it is the embracing of the freedom not to have to live in fear of the gun. Again, that's from the Brisbane newspaper editorial. Chris Eads is the chairman of the Munro County chapter of Scope. Chris, first of all, you look at Australia. Is it even feasible to you, as a leader of Scope here locally, that this is the kind of thing that would be tried in this country?
Well, first, I'd like to say that, you know, the best way not to live in fear of a gun is to have one yourself and be able to defend yourself by returning fire. Now, as to whether that would be feasible, I do not think it would be feasible in this country. I mean, you look at what Connecticut and New York, who have recently, you know, passed these assault weapon bans and required registration, the registration targets have fallen far below the estimated number of guns owned. Americans they won't stand for it. I mean, they won't stand for being deprived of their property and their right to defend themselves. And it's just logistically going to be too difficult to remove all the guns. And I think also it's, you know, criminals have always been able to have guns. But I think it's worth noting now that with 3D printers, I mean, this has just become a thing. But now you can make a gun, right? You can pay maybe $1,000 for a 3D printer, and you can make a gun in your living room. And, you know, it's in 10 years from now, it's going to be a lot easier to do this. The guns are going to be of higher quality that can be produced this way, and this just the genie's out of the bottle.
Okay, so a couple of points before I get to our other guests. Because the numbers are clear here. The rate of gun ownership in this country, almost a gun per person, close to one gun per citizen in this country. And I think Yemen is second with roughly half the rate of gun ownership. I mean, no other country is close. 8 million firearms are produced around the world every year, and Americans buy 4.5 million of them. So, I mean, we are buying more than the rest of the world combined, and we already own much, much more than the rest of the world. We also have the highest homicide rate by guns. It's not even close. We have the highest suicide rate by guns. We have the highest just about everything rate by guns. And it is fair. It's not just assault rifles. In fact, assault rifles is a small portion of that. But I guess where I want to start with this is this, Chris. I am not here to take any sides. I'm looking at data, and I don't have any clue right now how to make this better, because I'm kind of with you on the fact that a widespread national confiscation is probably a non-starter. It wouldn't be like Australia. We couldn't do 3 million guns, let alone 100 million, which would not even be that big of a dent. But if you could create a country from scratch right now, wouldn't you do it in a way that is designed to reduce the rate of gun deaths? And that means looking at the numbers that say the more guns equals the more gun deaths. Therefore, if you were starting from scratch, would you change it? We can't start from scratch. I get that. But would you change it if you were starting from scratch?
Well, you know, I think it's important to you know, not just look at gun deaths, but all deaths. In doing some research before I came on this show about Australia, you know, I ran into an article got it here. It's I got it because it really it shows, right? It's by Vox. And it starts with Australia confiscated so many guns, murders and suicides plummeted. And you think that's great. When you actually read the article, they're talking about murders with guns and suicide with guns, which is not, of course, what's in the headline. And when you look at all murders and all suicides, you see that across the world and even in developed nations, they actually have very similar rates to the United States. They just use knives or blunt objects instead of guns, right? So it's misleading to say, oh, well, we have this high rate of of homicide by guns, when in fact, in other countries, they simply use other weapons. I mean, there's another thing.
You don't think our homicide rate is higher than Australia's? It is. And just in terms of some numbers, 67% of American homicides are committed with guns. In Australia, it's 17%. In the United States, 42% of robberies involve guns. In Australia, 7%. So the numbers are very, very different. Australians just don't have as many guns. They own about one gun for every nine people. We have about one gun for every one.
Right. But they just use knives. I mean, that's my point.
Yeah, but they don't kill as many people. They don't. You know, their homicide rate's far lower. I mean, the other crime, you're right. In terms of attempted robberies and burglaries, things like that, they use guns less, but the actual attempts and violence and those things, you're right. The United States, Australia, Europe, mostly the same. The difference is more people die here, you know. More people are dead by gun. Right? I mean, that's the only difference. So I'm just kind of curious, if we were starting from scratch, you wouldn't change anything based on our current law.
No, because I believe that we have a human right to self-defense using the same weapons that are likely to be used against us. And as I've said before, we've never been able to keep criminals from having guns. And with technology, it's becoming, you know, basically impossible. And the only question is, can the good guys shoot back or not?
All right. Let me bring in Colette Martin from Parents Against Gun Violence. Colette, on the question of Australia, you heard President Obama invoke it. You heard the discussion with our editor of the Innovation Trail, who is a native Australian. Is that a non-starter in your eyes, or do you think some kind of ban and confiscation of high-powered weapons is pursuable in this country?
Hi, good morning. Thanks, Evan. To get right to it, yeah, I would agree with Chris on this one. I don't see the logistical route. If something passed constitutional muster and a gun confiscation buyback was brought into the United States, I don't logistically see how that could realistically happen. So aside from all the constitutional issues that are implicit in that, we have a different system of government, we have a different history here. I myself am a gun owner, as well as my husband. So, you know, to further that point, I don't really hear of any legitimate gun violence prevention organization that's pushing for an Australian-type buyback confiscation. The genie is out of the bottle in America. We have 300 million guns here. They're going to be around long past your lifetime and mine. So we need to deal with the problem as it stands rather than, you know, the hypotheticals and the rhetorical.
Well, let me ask Colette and Gary Puttup then to respond to what Hugh Hewitt, who is a conservative town hall columnist and a radio host, said about the question on what to do. He writes the following: when you use the phrase common sense gun control measures, it's a signal that there are no such specific things, because if there were such a thing, there would be broad public support and they would have passed by now. He goes on to write, because there aren't any such measures, save actual confiscation of weapons, which the president, candidate Clinton, and even the New York Times lacks the courage to demand, much less the ability to deliver via constitutional amendment, we can consider that nothing is going to happen. That's Hugh Hewitt. He's basically saying, if you want to confiscate, be honest about it, and if you don't, nothing's going to happen. What do you think? Colette?
Well, I mean, I think that that's just factually incorrect, among other adjectives I could used to describe it. I think that there are plenty of common sense things that can be done and are being done, and the statistics bear that out. States with tougher gun laws have lower rates of gun violence across the board. They have fewer accidents. They have fewer cops killed by guns, and I think that works. Now, where the idea of an Australian-type response has appeal is that something has to be done at the federal level. The current patchwork quilt that we have of tough gun laws, with bordering states with loose gun laws, is killing people every day.
Gary Puttup?
Yeah, to follow up a little bit on what Colette has said, you know, I think as we start this conversation, there's one thing that we need to understand. There is no place in the United States of America that has tough gun laws. Not New York, not California, nowhere. We have stronger gun laws in New York and places like California and Connecticut than other states. But to describe our gun laws, even in New York, as being strong or tough, is inaccurate. I mean, in New York State, you do not need to register long guns. There is no universal background checks, And there's nothing that can be done about, or in New York and California, there's nothing that's done about the sale of ammunition. In regards to some of the comments that were made, one of the things I think we need to keep in mind too, Evan, is when you talk about the number of guns, that the sister figure to that is the percentage of gun owners. And what we have is there are actually fewer gun owners as a percentage of the population in the United States. It's just that few percent is buying more guns.
A lot of guns. It's like a third of American households right now.
Yes. Right. And there are many, many instances where people in the past, or 20 years ago, may have owned one or two or three guns. And now people are owning, as we saw, like in Oregon, 14, 15, 16, 20.
Okay.
Not that that's not a comment or a judgment on those people that own those guns.
You're just looking at the numbers.
But it's just looking at the numbers and the number of people it affects. One of the things, too, is in regard to Hewitt's a comment about broad support. You know, we've done surveys even here in New York State, and I think you're familiar with that, that there is broad support for comprehensive gun laws and gun control. It's the political reality is, and this I'm sure you can do other shows on this, is the money that's involved. It's not that there isn't broad support. It's that the broad support doesn't have the kind of money organizations like SCOPE, New York State Pistol and Rifle Association, and then the NRA have. I mean, we have instances where Smith & Wesson just gave $12 million to the NRA. Midway USA, a gun accessory manufacturer, just gave $12 million to the NRA. So when we talk about broad support, are we talking about broad money? Or the number of population. When we did our survey here in New York State, we found the vast majority of New Yorkers, even in rural areas, want comprehensive gun control,
okay,
particularly among women.
I'm going to back it up for a second because, yep, I want to say, when we talk about comprehensive gun control, again, that's a nebulous term. The goal this hour is to be solution-oriented. So let's move on from Australia. Let me ask you this question. Should the president stop invoking Australia if not even New Yorkers against gun violence thinks that we could do here what Australia did? Isn't it time to stop invoking Australia?
Well, let's be clear. Australia was far more than confiscation. And this is what we mean by comprehensive. In regards to your earlier figure, the research is only 20% of the guns were, quote-unquote, confiscated or bought back. So keep in mind, Australians kept 80% of their guns. But what they did do, and similar to Canada and the UK, and I frequently refer to us in Australia and New Zealand as the frontier nations of the British Empire. So we share a similar history in our rights, going back to the Magna Carta. Our cultures may be somewhat different, but we do share that background. And so some of the comprehensive gun control would be things like registration, permitting, universal background checks.
Cooling off periods.
Cooling off periods.
Safe storage mandates as well.
Safe storage mandates.
Safe storage and then a written reason to own a gun, which is sort of many Americans find that strange. Australia did that. You've got to have a written, it's called like a genuine reason to own a gun.
Well, and to keep in mind about the comprehensive stuff again too, Evan, there's like six or seven classifications of guns in Australia. So it's very easy to have a justification like, I want a target shoot. Okay, fine. As opposed to, and that allows you access to certain types of guns. As opposed to, you know, somebody that lives in the outback, as our earlier guest said, you know, they need to control feral pigs,
yes,
varmints, or whatever. That person may need a semi-automatic centerfire rifle, and so, you know, they're allowed to have that. Now in Canada, they don't have that reason thing, but they still have registration. So I would suggest is we are not exactly like Australia. We are not exactly like Canada, the UK, or New Zealand. However, we share a common heritage, and that we can use that common heritage to look at how they did things and do it here. Again, this is not uncharted territory. The answer is out there. It's just a matter of political will. Can I just add one thing? It's as if these countries, somebody in Australia had found the cure for cancer. And somehow in America, we have to figure out that we need to reinvent the wheel and come up with that cure.
But Gary, there's listeners who are hearing you, and they're saying, I guarantee you there are some listeners who are saying, I'm ready, I support confiscation, and not even New Yorkers Against Gun Violence supports it. So I think you're actually going to disappoint some people. But what you're saying is when we talk about Australia, we can't go to confiscation. Not going to happen in this country. It's the other things that went with it, the registration, the much more stringent sort of mechanisms in place to help parse out who gets it and why and how long, et cetera. Yes?
Yeah, I think the key is look at what worked for them and apply that to our situation. Now, we have in our Fifth Amendment a due process and compensation clause, and that's how where eminent domain comes from. So, you know, one of the things is dealing with facts, and I'm not saying promoting this, but to say that the Constitution prohibits confiscation isn't exactly accurate.
But you're not calling for it. You don't want it.
Well, it would just be too costly.
All right. So we're
however, but we take that, but we take the Australian lesson, and we say, but can we in the future, can we please ban assault rifles? I mean, it was used in Oregon, and these are the really lethal things. Can we do that? And they will go away in time. If I could just one thing, and I'll move on. I know you want to move on. Back in 1964, when Barry Goldwater was running for president of the United States, the Gun Control Act of 1968 was up for debate. And Senator Goldwater said, you know, if we started banning guns, it would take us 50 years to get rid of these dangerous guns. So we shouldn't do it. And that's what we're hearing from the NRA today.
That was 51 years ago.
But that was 50, yeah, it was longer, yeah, that was during the campaign, so it was longer ago than that. So we wouldn't have this problem. At some point in time, you have to look at what the cures are and start acting. What we're doing now just isn't working.
Okay, well, but we are unique as a nation. There are no nations in the world with nearly the number of firearms in circulation and coming in, and if we're not going to see the leading gun control groups call for gun confiscation, then the question is, what can work? Chris Eads is the chapter is the Monroe County chapter of SCOPE chairman. That's the Shooters Committee on Political Education. Chris, just in case anybody wanted to talk about confiscation, honest question: do you think there would be armed resistance if law enforcement came to confiscate guns?
You know, I think there would be some armed resistance. I mean, I think what would probably happen is
non-compliance.
Yeah, I mean, I think more like civil disobedience or non-compliance. I mean, people would say, "Oh, I was hunting; it fell in the lake. I don't have it anymore." And they would simply conceal the weapons. I mean, I think that's not only easier but a lot more intelligent.
Okay.
As a response.
Okay. Interestingly enough, because you're a libertarian, yes.
Correct.
Michael Shermer is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. Are you a subscriber to Skeptic? Do you know Michael Shermer?
I do not.
Okay, Michael is Skeptic Magazine, longtime libertarian, and he had some very interesting things to say about this. Here's what he wrote in a piece this weekend about gun control. He said, quote, "As an adult for a quarter century, I owned a Ruger 357 Magnum pistol with hollow-tip bullets designed to rip to shreds a human body intruding into my home with the intent to harm my family. After I started having marital problems, I took it out of the house and eventually got rid of it. Having studied the psychology of human violence and knowing the statistics cited about a gun being 22 times more likely to be used on yourself or a family member than a home invader. I'm not saying everyone has to make the same choice as me, but I looked at the stats. That was my choice." What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, you know, I'd have to see where those statistics were coming from.
They're pretty well cited.
Well, I don't know about. I mean, more likely to be used on you than a home invader. I mean, it's. I mean, people do get into domestic disputes, right? And I mean, I think, you know, first of all, you want to look at, you know, who's the weaker party in that situation, right? If you take the gun away, you know, it's going to be the guy that's, you know, going to be perpetrating the violence. He doesn't need the gun necessarily, right?
So you're saying the woman who's generally just physical stature-wise might need a gun, right?
Right.
But we almost never see women use guns in domestic violence to protect them. I mean, that's like a unicorn story. We almost never see that.
Well, I mean, and a lot of the problem is, like, you know, if someone is beating you up, it's still against the law to kill them. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, we do see trials, and it's very, you know, people tend to be sympathetic towards the victim. But if you kill somebody, right, and you have to be able to prove that they were about to kill you to get away with it and have it justified.
So should that change?
You know, I mean, I'm not an expert in the issue of domestic violence. I mean, I certainly think that if someone threatens you, You know, you should go to the police and you should report that. I mean, with issues of domestic violence, the question is, you know, do you have the financial and you know, emotional ability to extract yourself from that
situation?
Right,
but we're just trying to, I just want to deal with reality here, which is the numbers do say that if you've got a gun at home, it is much more likely to be used accidentally or in suicide or in domestic violence slash homicide against women. That's just what the numbers say. You're suggesting that women could much more successfully use them if they just knew that when they went to trial, they wouldn't be charged with murder.
Well, that would certainly be one thing. And I think also we're seeing a lot more women, you know, get permits for the use of you know, handguns, concealed carry permits. I mean, I think we're also we're seeing a general cultural shift now. I mean, not just women, but minorities are using guns and getting permits to use guns in record numbers. So it's not, you know, there's a general demographic shift there.
Okay. Colette Martin on the phone from New York City, Parents Against Gun Violence. So what do you make of Chris's comments there?
I'm speechless a little bit, only because none of what Chris is saying is borne out by evidence. And if we want to keep having this conversation, we are duty-bound to do it in a responsible, fact-based evidence way. And I say that to you as a citizen, as a mom, as a gun owner. We need to start talking about statistics. The 22 times more likely to injure yourself or other statistic is fact. It has been studied. And there are plenty of sources for that. I don't want anyone's eyes to glaze over.
No, they are. And Colette, I spent the last 3 days poring over this stuff, and that's right. That is very well documented.
It is just, it's not a subject of debate to me. So let's put that off the table because it is, in fact, true. That is the reason, as a gun-owning parent, that I have a gun safe, that I have trigger locks, that I store my ammunition separately, because I know for a fact the guns that are in our home, and we have more guns than people in my house, are a greater threat to those of us who live here than to any theoretical home invader that might come to steal my plasma TV. That is fact. Responsible gun owners are the key to this debate, both on a political and a cultural level. And I really am heartened by the fact that so many gun owners are getting very loud and very angry about somehow being co-opted by the gun lobby, who are just coming out with the most ridiculous panic and inflammatory statements after every mass shooting, after every tragedy that we see. The NRA and its affiliates do not speak for me as a gun owner. And again, evidence-based. 94% of gun owners in this country are not members of the NRA. So what does that tell you?
Chris Eads, response, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, how many, you know, there's a political group called ABATE, American Bikers Aim Towards Education, a motorcycle group that advocates for legislation like, for instance, left on red, where the triggers don't register the weight of the motorcycle and they sit at red lights forever. I mean, they have a lot of legislative issues. A very, very tiny percentage of motorcycle riders are members of them. I mean, Thierry was talking about money. I mean, the NRA has 5 million members. It is the largest, and, you know, not corporations, individual people, and it is probably the largest political lobby organization in the country, and that's because they have lots and lots of people that support what they do. And so, you know, like I said, not everybody is a joiner, but certainly the fact that they are the largest, you know, political lobby group in the country and have over 5 million members speaks a lot for the support that they have.
Well, here's, I got to get to a break, and then we'll come back with some of your phone calls. Here's what I think about that, Chris. I think the NRA enjoys the fact that we are so divided. And what I mean by that is we are othering people who divide don't share our opinion on this issue. We don't view them as Gary. You know, I know Gary respects you and you respect Gary, and I wish everyone could be like this, because I know that Chris Eads does not think that his guns are more important than the safety of my son. I don't believe you believe that for a second. I believe you actually believe that having guns would make me a safer father in the house. I really believe that you think that. So I don't want to come here and think you don't care about my son's safety. That doesn't get us anywhere. And I really think that Chris doesn't believe that Gary or Colette are soft and just want government tyranny and don't want freedom. I mean, I really believe, but we only are going to get somewhere if we get specific about what can change and we show respect and maybe a willingness to give here, because this is intractable right now, and the NRA benefits when it is intractable. Nothing changes. This is not going to change anything unless we make that effort. So let's get a short break in. Your phone calls next, and we'll try to, again, continue by the civil guidelines of the program right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it's our monthly science roundtable, and we look at the science of Back to the Future 2. Back to the Future 2 was set in October 2015, far into the future. Well, that's now. We'll see if their predictions about what the world would look like were correct. From hoverboards to video phones and more, Back to the Future 2 under our microscope next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guests for the hour are talking about specifics when it comes to trying to reduce the level of gun violence in this country. I've heard from some listeners who say there is no epidemic of gun violence here. Gun violence was already on the decline in Australia before their ban. And violence across the world is dropping. The nice thing is that's true. Violence around the world is on the decline. This is the safest time ever to be alive as a human being on this planet. That's a very, very good thing. There just happens to be one country where the rate of homicide and death by gun far, far, far outpaces the others. Most of those are not mass shootings. Most of those are homicides, suicides, etc. Most of those involve handguns, not assault rifles. Those are just some of the facts. But the facts do bear out that the higher the rate of gun ownership, the fact that there are more guns around leads to more gun violence, despite how many people say, I'm a responsible gun owner. That's just what the facts bear out. That's not an accusation against anybody. Again, I think we're all on the same side here. I think we all want safety for our families, our children, etc. But we are trying to look at the facts here. Our guest on the phone with us from New York City is Colette Martin from Parents Against Gun Violence. Colette, your group is online. Where can they find you?
We are on Facebook, Parents Against Gun Violence, and we're also on the web at parentsagainstgunviolence.org.
Gary Putup's here from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Chris Eads is here, the chairman of the Monroe County chapter of SCOPE. That's the Shooters Committee on Political Education. And let's get to some of our phone calls. Rich in Rochester is first up. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello. Just to speak on this, there's several points I want to make. Real quick, 5 million members of the NRA doesn't even come close to the AARP, which has 40 million members. That's number one. Number two, what's insidious about gun violence, and I think Chris said, well, people get stabbed. Stabbing someone takes a tremendous amount of physical effort, and you have to be in close proximity to someone. With a gun, you can kill them from up a range, if you're a great shot, up to 800, 900 yards. So to compare knife violence to gun violence is another non-starter. Also, the thing about the gun is that the product that you're talking about has to be made to be last 100 years because of just the quality of it. You don't want this thing to be destroyed. So you have an industry that makes a product that never goes bad. How do they keep selling them? Outside of the Defense Department, how do you keep selling them? And then also Chris made a statement about, well, we have to be able to defend ourselves against criminals. The Second Amendment has nothing to do with criminality at all. So that, again, that's off the table. But I think it's just the insidiousness of the misinformation out there, and also just what the product itself is. And also the argument about mental illness, that means that the U.S. has this blip of mental illness that no other country in the world has,
no other
developed country. So I think that's a non-starter. Some of these arguments are very weak at best.
Rich, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. And let me just say, to Rich's point on mental health, we're going to spend a separate hour of this program on a separate day on mental health. But I would direct all of you to read Michael Shermer's piece for Skeptic Magazine this weekend. He goes into the difficulty in predictive mental health prevention with gun violence. What it comes down to is this. Someone has Asperger's. Someone has some other depression. That is not predictive of violence. Psychopathy tends to be more predictive of violence. That's a small percentage of the population, about 0.5% of women, 2% of men. That's millions of people in this country, by the way. You can't round them up and imprison them. And by the way, a very, very small percent of people with psychopathy. end up violent. And a very small percentage of them kill multiple people. So you can't round up tens of thousands or millions, even if you prove that they have psychopathy. It is a very, very difficult problem. And yes, psychopathy exists in other countries as well. So that has been a kind of red herring. I urge you all to read Michael Shermer's piece on that. And let me start with Gary. Brief response to what you just heard from Rich. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, thanks, Rich. And just for the NPR listeners, I hope they go to the WXXI website and look at bring up the Diane Rehm Show podcast from her first hour this morning. And there was some very good discussion about the mental health issue being just the straw dog argument, that less than 1% of people that suffer from any kind of mental health challenge are at all violent. And again, to point to some of the other things that Rich brought up, you know, the NRA touts that they have between 4 and 5 million members is still less than 2% of the American population. And the idea that they can use their wealth and power to dictate to the 99% of the American population what's good for them is speaks volumes. And in addition to the weapons is, you know, I had 30 years experience responding to suicides, homicides, and violent crimes. The lethality of a gun over a knife is hardly comparable. And in addition to that, when we talk about 2/3 of the gun violence in this country being suicides, you know, I can't remember exactly how many suicides by knife I went to, but suicide by gun was routine. And in fact, in an earlier question that Evan had about comprehensive gun control, maybe in the future we would like to discuss the Gun Violence Restraining Order Act that we're going to be pushing for legislation for next year, which is in effect in California, and it's been very successful.
Okay, I want to get to Mike, who has a specific question for Chris. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I happened to listen to the Diane Rehm Show this morning, and Richard Feldman, who is the representative of the Independent Firearms Owners Association, was on the panel. And someone asked him whether he would support the funding of research to determine the scope of the problem involving violence and guns here in the U.S. He went on to talk about mental health issues, which seems to be the easiest way to avoid discussing that situation or that question. I would ask the scope representative the same question, since you believe that firearms are important to the country. But I think you may recognize that they figure again and again and again in firearms deaths in this country. Would you support the funding of real research into the effects that firearms have had upon our statistics involving death and crime? Would you support that legislation? And if not, sir, why not?
Thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Chris Eads.
Oh, I certainly support research of all kinds. I certainly think that a private organization that wants to do research, they can do it now and they should do it. Now, the question is, when the money comes from the government, then it becomes politicized. Then it becomes a question of, you know, who is providing the money, and what is their goal. So I think when it comes to public funding, I would be opposed to it because that always comes with a political agenda.
You don't think anybody with private money to give ever has a political agenda? Come on.
Oh, no. I mean, that's there too. I'm just saying.
All right, I'll put up half the money. Gary puts up, I'll put up a quarter. Gary puts up a quarter. You put up a quarter. You find somebody else. And we all feel good about it. How's that? The notion that any research is going to be politicized is a way to sort of stop research, isn't it?
Well, yes. Research, there's always a political element to research. The question is, you know, should the taxpayers be footing the bill for politically motivated research? Or, you know, the when it's done by the government, that sort of gives it, at least in some people's minds, the appearance of neutrality when it really isn't there. I mean, if you have like privately funded research, then who's giving the money, and you have, I think it's more, in a sense, transparent.
Okay, I'm with you on transparency. Transparency would be very good. We've got a few minutes left, and we've got to talk about what might now change this problem. Because first of all, Chris, you at least concede we've got a gun violence problem in this country, yes or no?
Well, I mean, all violence is a problem. Right. And I mean,
but we don't have a special gun violence problem?
Because we have more guns, the acts of violence that are committed tend to you know, involve guns. I mean, I know people can't see this at home, but speaking of Australia, I mean, you see like the use of knives and guns commit homicides, and this graph here shows, you know, the guns going down and the knives going up, you know, in almost exactly the same proportion.
But don't you wish, like, if someone's going to try to kill you in your life, I mean, that's a terrible thing to think about, but I'd rather they use a knife than a gun on me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question is, right, how can I defend myself, right? Am I going to have a knife or a gun to defend myself when they attack me?
Okay. So here's where I want to go with this in the last few minutes here. Gary and Colette have said their organizations do not support the confiscation portion of what Australia did following the 1996 Port Arthur massacre. So as much as some Americans may think they want that, even some leading reform groups say, no, confiscation not happening. That's giving a step, because I suspect in his heart, Gary might say, okay, what do you need an assault rifle? But he's not going there. Where do you think you can give, Chris? And where can Scope say, we can sign up for XYZ reform? What's reasonable?
Well, I mean, I am not hearing proposals that I think would actually be efficacious. And like you were saying, I agree,
Chris, can I give you one?
Go ahead, Colette.
To weigh in on? Because I really think at a national level, if we were to get this done, we would see a dramatic and almost immediate effect in the gun violence death rates in our country. A safe storage proposal is pending in New York State right now, Nicholas's law. It passed the Assembly. It wasn't voted on in the Senate. We're pushing to get that done. If that could happen at a national level, like other countries that we've discussed today, Australia, the UK, Canada, you cannot in those countries leave your loaded gun lying around. And there are a multitude of reasons why doing so is a bad idea. Not just the daily tragedies that play out where children get a hold of a gun and kill themselves or a sibling or a friend, and that happens every day, trust me.
But Colette, let me just jump in with a question before Chris answers. How are you protecting your family if you don't have a gun quickly available to you should someone come into your home? And I say quickly available and loaded.
My gun is quickly accessible to me with a numeric keypad safe.
Okay. Chris Eads, what do you think about her proposal?
Yeah. No, I'm not actually. Okay. That's a good example, right? And I think they're, you know, you want to look at the details and you make sure that it is actually accessible quickly. But yeah, actually, you know, and maybe I should dig it out. I actually did, and this aired on RCTV, the local public access thing in Rochester, a public service announcement about the quick access gun safes. Maybe I should provide that footage to Evan. And so I actually went on television and said, here's a quick access gun safe, and we demonstrated how to use it. So I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I think
I definitely
also
learned something in that moment. I sure did. I mean, I did not know these things existed, and I'm in many ways heartened to hear that.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah.
Did you see that? Yeah, you saw me, yeah. So, I mean, that's not a problem. And as long as you can keep it loaded, like, while you're sleeping in the drawer next to you, if you need it for you know, and I think that exception is in most of these laws.
Colette, is your firearm loaded at home?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So there's somewhere, we've got some common ground there. Gary, we've got 90 seconds. What's another quick proposal that you would throw out there?
The gun violence restraining order. One of the things we see in these cases, very often we'll hear friends and family, and we hear this even in the Oregon tragedy, that people are saying, you know, the shooter or even on our local homicides, there was something different going on with this person. And somebody may obtain a gun when they're mentally stable. And everybody has bad days. Everybody has sad days. But what the gun violence restraining order would do, it would allow friends, family, to contact the police, who could then petition a court. So this would be judicial. This wouldn't be a police confiscation, but would be able to petition a court for what would be similar to an Article 78 hearing in New York. A judge could review and take those guns until the person was past their crisis. That would be huge. They do it in California, and it's very effective.
Chris Eads?
Well, I'd have to see the details, but that doesn't sound like a bad idea offhand. You know, depends on the standard of proof that's used.
Okay, and we've heard proposals. Nick Kristof from the New York Times calling for a 10-year ban for anyone who's been convicted of domestic violence. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I don't any crime of violence. I mean, I think that you know, you you should not have the tools of violence available to you. Like, I don't have any problem with that.
Okay. Colette, I'm going to give you the last word here. We're down about 30 seconds here. What do you want to leave our audience with? Go ahead.
Thanks so much. Maybe pertinent to the second half of your show, the mental illness canard, as I see it, all the presidential candidates, the NRA, the gun lobby talking about this mental illness issue. We are not by nature more deranged, more mentally ill than any other country in the world. It is the lunacy of easy access to guns that is killing Americans daily.
To Colette's point there again, and Michael Shermer writes about psychopathy, and even if you narrow it down, you cannot round people up and violate civil liberties. I think Chris Eades would say, as a libertarian, you can't put somebody in jail before they commit a crime just because you think they will. And most people with psychopathy don't. You agree with that, Chris?
I agree.
Okay. So, look, we're not that. We've got some common ground here. We're working on it. We're doing it respectfully. And I want to thank all of our callers and listeners. Really just swamped this hour. Colette Martin, Parents Against Gun Violence. Thank you very much, Colette. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Chris Eades from Scope, Monroe County. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Evan.
And Gary Putup from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, among others. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, more connections next.